Evening. Greet you all this evening in the name of Lord Jesus Christ. Our brother has asked us to read from Matthew 5, starting at verse 33 to the end of the chapter. Matthew 5, starting at verse 33. Again, ye have heard it hath been said by them of old time, Thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, Thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. That ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if ye salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. So I'm sure our brother's going to touch on some of these thoughts here this evening in his message, and we're looking forward to that here in a couple minutes. But just a couple of thoughts I had here when I read over this, thinking about, first off, thinking about non-resistance, and I guess first thing that comes probably to a lot of our minds is not going to war or not taking up arms and fighting in war. But non-resistance and, not retaliating, not fighting back is a whole lot more than just not fighting in a war, in a battle like that. But it's something that is and should be a part of our everyday lives. We all face hurts and struggles and, people who mistreat us or hurt us in some way, and our natural flesh is to want to retaliate, to fight back. But Jesus is asking us here to, or telling us to, not retaliate. But another thought I had was, and that's hard enough on its own sometimes. But Jesus takes it even a step further. Not only are we not supposed to retaliate and fight back and return evil for evil, but he actually commands us to love our enemies, to bless those that curse us, and pray for those who despitefully use us. And that's taking it to a whole nother level that's even more difficult many times. But that's who Jesus is, and that's the way Jesus did things, and that's the way he wants us to do things. Let's bow for a word of prayer.
Thank you, Josh, for your prayer and also for your comments. It's really the heart of the idea of non-resistance that you got to there. That it's not just not retaliating, but it's going further than that and even loving those who would oppose you. The message this evening, I don't know that you would call it so much a sermon because I want to talk some of it just in information too. The topic, as has already been shared, is non-resistance and the draft and alternative service. Now, non-resistance, I know we have talked about some, but to get into the specifics of some of the implications of that for military service and how that could affect things, we don't talk about that a whole lot anymore. It's not something that is active right now. And previous generations, I guess my father's generation was probably about the last where it was really something that they had to face firsthand and consider what they were going to do in those situations. By the time I came along, it was no longer in place, and so it wasn't something that I ever thought about so much. And especially now that it's been quite a few years, really, removed since it's been active, kind of tend to forget about it. But it is something that is still potential, and it's been broadened a little. The idea of it has been broadened is from what it used to be, so we'll talk about that some also. But first of all, the idea of non-resistance, the New Testament doctrine of non-resistance. Now, we talk about how our church does not believe in going to war and participating in armed conflict and defending ourselves with the use of deadly force, things like that. But hopefully, when we talk about it, we understand that it isn't just something that our church says we don't do. Anytime we talk about these things, especially when they're distinctives, different from the way other churches do them, because most evangelical churches don't really get into the idea of non-resistance. In fact, a lot of them kind of go the other way and glorify the idea of participating in the military. It's important to know the principles. If any of you are ever called before somebody and have to explain your beliefs of why you don't want or why you're refusing to participate in the military, I hope you can say more than just, well, my church doesn't believe in that. You need to know the principles behind it too. And the idea of non-resistance, obviously I'm not going to spend the whole time this evening on that. And there's a lot that can be addressed with non-resistance too. But just to establish that first before we talk about the draft and alternative service. Something else I think we need to remember, sometimes those of us who were raised brethren, or in this case Mennonite also, we talk about these things as being brethren or Anabaptist or Mennonite distinctives, and they are in a sense that they're not shared by all churches. But these are not things that are the basis or the foundation of our faith. As brethren, or if you grew up Mennonite, that's not the most important thing. The important thing was still to be a follower of Jesus Christ. Non-resistance is a simple way to live out what Jesus said for his followers. So it doesn't make us his followers, but we do it because we are his followers. And I don't, on the topic of thinking about being brethren or Mennonite or Anabaptist, this is not something that I believe in because the old brethren said it and therefore I believe it. It's in the Bible. It's in the New Testament. And that's really the basis for it. Not because it's something that they did and they passed it down. They believed it also because it's in the Bible, in the New Testament. So it's for that reason that we teach it and try to practice it. Now, the term non-resistance comes right here from Matthew chapter 5, verse 39. Jesus says, "But I say unto you that ye resist not evil." Now, what does that mean? There's a lot of things that are contained in that. And Josh is right. It's a lot more than it mean than meaning just we don't go to war. I don't know how to pronounce this man's name. Finney Kuravilla, is that how you pronounce it? Something like that. King Jesus Claims His Church is his book. His way of describing non-resistance is, instead of fighting against their enemies, Jesus' followers are to love their enemies, bless them, and generously serve them. That's non-resistance. And he says it encompasses the peaceful, non-retaliatory, and loving disposition toward a person's enemies. Non-resistance is meeting hatred with love and violence with peace. Now, non-resistance, as the Brethren and the Mennonites traditionally have taught it and observed it, isn't the same as pacifism. There are a lot of people in the Church of the Brethren and in the Mennonite Church today who would call themselves pacifists. But someone who is a pacifist isn't necessarily non-resistant. Just being a pacifist means you believe in peace, not in violence. It's more non-violence than non-resistance. You can be a pacifist, and you can still hate your enemies, and you can still oppose your enemies. It's just you don't use violence to do it. You use peaceful methods instead. So non-resistance and pacifism are not the same thing. We believe that Jesus taught more than just pacifism. He taught non-resistance. And as Josh said, it goes beyond the idea of not retaliating. It goes on to actively loving your enemies. New Testament support for this doctrine. Of course, we just read Matthew chapter 5, Jesus' teaching here in the Sermon on the Mount. I'm going to give you several references that I won't read. There's too many of them, really. These are direct references in the New Testament to the idea of being non-resistant as his followers. Matthew chapter 26, verse 52. Luke 6, 27 to 36. John 18, 36. And I do want to read this from Romans chapter 12, because apart from the Sermon on the Mount, this is probably one of the clearest passages that explains being non-resistant and living it out. Romans chapter 12, verses 17 through 21. Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. And continuing on with other references, 2 Corinthians 10:4, 1 Thessalonians 5:15, 1 Peter 2:21 to 23. I'm going to also read that because Josh mentioned how Jesus was our example in that, and this is what Peter is saying here. 1 Peter chapter 2, starting with verse 21. For even hereunto were ye called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that ye should follow his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. And then another reference, Revelation chapter 13, verse 10. And these are direct references to the idea of being non-resistant as followers of Jesus. And there's a lot more that are not direct where the idea is implied or there's something that is one of the principles underlying non-resistance that are taught. Now, what is non-resistance based on? Brother Harold Martin, I guess a generation is coming on that we need to say more than just Brother Harold. We have to say Brother Harold Martin. In one of the BRF witnesses, this is from January, February of 2005, wrote the article, The New Testament Doctrine of Non-Resistance, lists several principles that underlie this of non-resistance. First is the idea of two kingdoms. Now, Finney Kuravilla, again, I don't know how to pronounce his name, talks about that idea of two kingdoms doesn't really connect with us, because how many kingdoms are you and I really familiar with at this point? I know that Great Britain is still technically a constitutional monarchy, but Queen Elizabeth really doesn't rule that nation. There really aren't places in the world anymore where there is an absolute monarch. And that's what Jesus was saying when he talked about a kingdom. So Finney says that we should say, another way of saying it that would relate to us is to talk about nations. There are two nations in a way. There's the nation of this world and there's the nation of Christ. And so Paul mentioned this morning of how what Jesus said was so revolutionary, because Jesus was saying, I am king, in a way, as opposed to Caesar being king. There are those two nations or two kingdoms. And that's one of the principles of non-resistance. There is the kingdom or the nation of Christ. And Brother Harold defines that as those who voluntarily believe in Jesus Christ and seek to become like him in daily conduct. So Jesus is the king of the kingdom of Christ, and if you are in his kingdom, if you're one of his subjects, then that basically just means you do what he says. The king tells his subjects what to do, and they obey him. As opposed to that, there's the kingdom or the nation of this world. And that would be a society that refuses to submit to the authority of Christ. It ignores Christ, or it even actively opposes him. And the New Testament clearly teaches that the entire world, all people, are divided into those two kingdoms. There is the kingdom of Christ, and there is the kingdom of this world, and every person is in one or the other of those kingdoms. But there is no overlap between those two kingdoms. You cannot be in both kingdoms at the same time. There's no dual citizenship, would be another way of saying it, because those two kingdoms are opposed to each other. If you are a follower of Christ, then you are in the kingdom of Christ. Christ is your ruler, and you submit to the authority of the rulers of this world only as long as your submission to the rulers of this world doesn't mean treason to the kingdom of Christ. Christ is your ultimate authority. So that's one of the foundations. The next, Harold says, is the Spirit of Christ is not the spirit of this world. And you think about that, and it's pretty clear. The way that this world runs things, and the way that they talk, the way that they think, that's not the way Christ spoke or talked or the things that he did. They're not the same. The spirit of the world and the spirit of Christ are different. The methods of Christ are not the same as the methods of this world. Paul wrote, the methods of our warfare are not carnal. That's one way of saying it. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal. Our weapons are spiritual, Paul says. And so our methods are not the same in the kingdom of Christ and the kingdom of this world. Another principle of non-resistance is the supremacy of agape love. What is it that Paul wrote was the greatest of all things, even greater than faith and hope, is agape love. The love that puts others before yourself. The love that Christ showed in his life when he put everyone else before himself and was willing to lay down his own life, Paul wrote, even for his own enemies. While we were still his enemies, he died for us to demonstrate his agape love for us. That's not the kind of love that the world knows. The duty of promoting peace is one of the principles of non-resistance. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. Rejection of retaliation is one of the foundations for non-resistance. Jesus said, don't retaliate. Paul wrote it also. We just read it in Romans. And the sacredness of human life. As believers and followers of Christ, we recognize that every individual has been created in the image of God and is given by Him that indelible stamp that says, this is someone who has the mark of his Creator on him. And we do not have the right to take that life away. That belongs to God. Human life is sacred. Now you will hear, and you may be thinking of some things that are objections to non-resistance. I'm not going to spend much time on this. Not because they can't be answered, but because I want to go on. But these are common things that you'll hear. As a Christian, you'll hear people say, well, Israel was commanded to fight. And people will say that we have the right to protect ourselves, that we have the responsibility to protect our loved ones, and that we have a duty, some will say even, to fight for our nation. But the New Testament calls the believer to a higher way of life. And the believer is always in the hands of God, and our highest duty is always to Christ. And this idea of non-resistance, sometimes I like to go back and see what the people who were closest to Jesus thought about an issue, because, you know, if I want to know what somebody said, it's best for me to go to the source and ask them directly. And if I can't ask the source directly, then I can ask somebody who heard it from them. Now, I can't go all the way back and say to Jesus, now, what did you really mean when you said this? But we can go back to people who knew the apostles. Who would have known better than the apostles what it was that Jesus meant when he said these things? And if they understood what he meant, then that's how they would have lived. So we go back, we can't really go back to the apostles other than the New Testament, which we have, and that's our authority. But if you need more than that, go to the ones who followed the apostles in the early church, the first generations right after the apostles. And we know what they believed on this idea of non-resistance. We know that personal violence among them is something that was forsworn. And we know that participation by Christians in the Roman army was virtually unheard of. And we know that if soldiers did become followers of Christ, then they had to, in some cases, do penance, it was called, for years before they were able to join the church. They needed to prove their loyalty to Christ if they had accepted him after being a soldier. Military participation among the church only started to come in maybe around in the 300s or so, the 4th century after Christ. Several hundred years, really. There were multiple reasons for this. And it really didn't become accepted until the time of Constantine, when he accepted Christianity and took away a lot of the restrictions and the persecution that was on Christians. And they welcomed that so much, and also there was other reasons of things that he did, that the church at that point started accepting military participation. But the ones who knew the apostles best, they knew what Jesus meant when he said this in the New Testament. Non-resistance has been the position of Anabaptists, and also from the Brethren ever since the beginning of each, whether it was the Anabaptists back in the 1500s or the Brethren in the 1700s. For both of them, non-resistance was their teaching and their practice. And it's been the practice of this church also. You'll notice if you read in our church constitution and bylaws that no member of this church can take or can join the military. And any member who does is automatically disfellowshipped, because non-resistance is a teaching of the New Testament, and we continue to uphold that and to practice that. And it's always been understood then that that prohibits participation in any service that would involve violence or bearing arms. Now, that's a very quick overview of non-resistance. I'm going to let Brother Harold again have the last words on this. Quoting from New Testament beliefs and practices, he wrote, "It is hard to believe that the true Christian can sight over the barrel of a gun aimed at another fellow human being and say, 'This is the will of God,' and then pull the trigger." And he says in his study of New Testament practices, doctrines, "One cannot have the Spirit of Christ in his heart and at the same time bear arms that threaten the lives of other humans." Now, practically, what does that have to do with some other things? I know Josh just mentioned about the idea of not retaliating even in personal relationships. And I know some of you have talked before about how that has affected you even in relationships with your neighbors. But specifically tonight, talking about something called the draft. And that's not been in place for a long time in this country. So those of you who are younger probably haven't thought a whole lot about it. From the Selective Service, this is the government agency that would administer the draft. The draft is the mandatory enrollment of individuals into the armed forces. Basically, the draft is being told by the government that you have to join the military. Not as a volunteer, as it is now with the military, but the draft would be they would choose and you'd have to go. A lot of nations around the world do have some kind of mandatory service in the military. Israel, I believe, still does. Other countries have until recently. Some have all volunteer forces, but a lot of countries, even if they have volunteer military, still have provisions in place for a draft, to conscript or to pull people into the military even if they don't want to join. In the United States, conscription was used in the American Revolution, in the Civil War, World War I, World War II, Korea, and the Vietnam Wars. I did learn that there was no draft used for the War of 1812. In fact, there was pretty strong opposition when it was considered, and there was no draft for the Mexican-American War, and there has been no draft for any military action since 1973. So things like the Gulf War in 89 and all of the other actions since 2001, there was no draft for any of those. But in the United States, if we go back to the American Revolution, Mennonites and Brethren and Amish were all here before that. And so it affected them. It affected them directly here in Pennsylvania. The colony of Pennsylvania had a militia, and then the militia would send troops to Washington's Continental Army. And there was conscription. The colonial government of Pennsylvania did, even though up until that time it had been mostly a Quaker government, by that time it wasn't totally a Quaker government, and they did conscript people into the military. And there were no provisions made if you were Brethren or Mennonite or Quaker. You were still told you had to go. Some of them were allowed to pay a fine to avoid conscription, and others lost property, reputation. I don't know of any who were imprisoned for long periods of time. There was a Brethren elder, Christopher Sauer II. He was a printer in Philadelphia, a wealthy man. And because he would not join and he wouldn't take an oath of allegiance to the colonial government, then his property was sold at auction to pay off all of this. And even in that time, his property brought $90,000, and all he was allowed to keep for himself were his eyeglasses. He lost all of that. He had Bibles that he had printed the pages for them. They confiscated those, and our own colonial army used the pages of Bibles that he had printed as wadding in their cannons for some of their battles. So he's an example of one who did sacrifice for his beliefs. He actually died living with his daughter, penniless, because he had lost everything. That was the American Revolution. In the Civil War, It definitely affected brethren and Mennonites. And I know I've heard stories of some who were connected with this church generations back, that when there was conscription for the Union Army, they lost some things. The North did have a provision that you could pay $300 so a substitute would go, but if you didn't believe in fighting in war, then you might have some problems with paying somebody else to go in your place too, which many did have a problem with that. The South, there really was no provision for this. Some lost their property, some were forced into the Southern Army. They really had no choice. They were marched at gunpoint in some cases, and told to go into the army. And in that case, all they could do was not pull the trigger on the guns when they were put into battle. And some said they did that. And they told their officers they wouldn't shoot either. World War I. There were official provisions for those who believed that it was wrong to go to war. But the problem was, they said that if you believed it was wrong for you to fight, then what they would do was put you into the army in a place where you wouldn't have to carry a gun or fight. Now, a lot of brethren and Mennonite boys that were in that position, they went ahead and they put on the uniform and they served in that way. But there were other brethren, Mennonite and Amish men, somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 that refused to put on a uniform even. Many of them were put into prison as, I don't know what the official military charge was, but it was a military charge. They said, you are a soldier and yet you're refusing to obey orders. And they were given a military trial, many of them, for that. The irony of it was, in World War I, the Church of the Brethren had changed enough by this time that there were a lot of brethren boys that volunteered. And really, the supreme irony, the governor of Pennsylvania during World War I was a brethren minister, Martin Broombaugh. And he had the responsibility to call out the Pennsylvania militia and enact the draft in Pennsylvania. So he put himself into that compromising position of going against the teaching of the Church of the Brethren by what he had done in serving as governor. World War II in Korea, things had changed some by then. There was official recognition of conscientious objectors, and there were alternative provisions made for them at this time. Talking with a brother this morning, that his father, who had been, was a member of this church, during Korean War served in alternative service down in Maryland. So that by that time, there were things that you could do if you were a conscientious objector to war. It's the same for Vietnam. Now, I've used some terms, and I want to define them. A combatant is one that you'll see if you look on the information for this. A combatant is one who actively fights in the military, and a non-combatant is someone who is in the military but does not actively fight or bear arms, and their duties do not require training to fight. That's one of the options that the military has tried to give, is non-combatant service. And they will say, well, if you don't believe that you should bear arms and fight, then we'll put you here where you don't have to carry arms and you don't have to fight. But think about what that really means. You might not be the one dropping the bombs from the plane, but you might be the one working on the planes that are going to drop the bombs. So you may have removed yourself one step from active participation in war, but you're still promoting the cause of war and of violence. And also, if someone is a non-combatant in the military, they still have to take an oath that they're going to fulfill their duties to the military. What was the first thing that Josh read tonight? Jesus said, don't swear at all. And so we also believe that Jesus taught us not to take an oath. And so that's ruled out then. I've used the term conscientious objector. The definition of this is one who is opposed to serving in the armed forces and or bearing arms on the grounds of moral or religious principles. I'll also talk a little bit about a draft board, or else if you read up on this, you'll read about a draft board. A draft board is just a local group. It would be from the local community. It's citizens. It's not, it's civilians. It's not the military. And they, if there would be a draft, or like it was back in Vietnam, if there was a draft, then all those who were drafted locally, any who applied for an exemption and said, I shouldn't have to go to war, they applied for an exemption, and the local draft board then had to consider those applications for exemption and decide whether or not they were going to approve them. Am I correct on that, those of you that went through that process? I think that's basically how it went. And that would still be in place today. Even though we don't have a draft, there are, in our communities, volunteers who have gone to the Selective Service and said, I will serve as on the draft board if it's ever put in place. And once a year, they meet and they train to consider what they would do. So that is still there. They would look at all the people who said, I shouldn't have to serve, and they would put them into categories. Currently, there aren't categories because there is no draft. The last time there were categories in Vietnam, 1A meant that you were, if that was your category, it meant you were available for military service. If you were called, you had to go. 1AO meant that you would not bear arms. You were a conscientious objector to bearing arms, but you would serve in the military as a non-combatant. 1W was the status for a conscientious objector who would not join the military and then would be assigned to do civilian work. And they defined it as civilian work that is in the national health, safety, or interest areas. You would be assigned to do something as a volunteer, basically, that would benefit society for 2 years. Basically, they said, if you won't go and join the military, then you at least have to serve your nation in some way. And so it was alternative service. Education, environment, health care, social services, community services, and agriculture. Different things that people did. I've heard of some who fought forest fires. They were firefighters out west during this time. There was a Dunkard Brethren man I had known who was a milk inspector during this time. I guess there were federal milk inspectors. I don't know if there still are, but there were then. And since people were going off and serving in World War II, they needed people to do that job, so they were milk inspectors. Torreo Navajo Mission used to be a place during the Vietnam War where people could serve as a volunteer, as a 1W volunteer. And I know a lot of the people from this church served in psychiatric hospitals. One over by Philadelphia, Norristown. The brother that I talked to this morning said his father served in Catonsville, Maryland. So there were other things like that some of you are more familiar with than I have been. And how many of you in here did serve in 1W service? Raise your hand, please. Okay, look around for a little bit. Those of you, keep your hands up, if you would. Thank you. And I know there are more that were here this morning that, okay, you can put your hands down now. Thank you. I know there were more here this morning who also served, but I know, and it might be your grandfather, it might be an uncle or something like that. Talk to them and ask them about this. Find out what it was like for them. It wasn't always easy even to go away and serve and... I've heard some of the stories of some of the things that people had to do in their alternative service, that it wasn't always the easiest. And even just to stand up for what you believe and to have to say, I don't believe in going to war, would be something that would be a test. Now, why am I talking about this when I say there it's not active? Nobody's been drafted in the United States since 1973. There has been no active draft since then. So how does this affect you And especially, everything that we've said so far about military service was for men, and yet I'm saying it affects, could potentially affect every youth at this point. All of this structure is still in place. There is nothing that has changed legally that the draft has been set aside completely. Legally, it is still there. There's the selective service system is still active. People still work for it, and they still run things. And so the potential is there that if there would be a time, then the draft could be reenacted. But if it were reenacted, technically right now, it still says just for males, but there are a lot of people who are trying to change that. One recent recommendation from some congressional committee was that it would include both males and females. And I think that the defense appropriation bill that the House of Representatives is considering would change that. Now, in order for it to change the status from both males to males and or from only males to both males and females, the Senate would also have to approve that change, and then it would have to be signed into law by the president. Right now, probably it would not pass our Senate, but it wouldn't take a whole lot before that would be possible. This is something that is pushed for pretty hard by some progressives. They believe that not only should women be allowed to volunteer and fight in combat, which they do now, but they believe that it's wrong to say only males would be drafted, that females should also be drafted. How would it work? Well, the first part, and this is something that, well, the first part is registration. When a young man turns 18, he is required by law to register with the Selective Service System. Now, in my day, we had to go to the post office and get this little card and fill it out and then send it in, and that's how you registered. And it's not something that at that time you say, I don't have to register because I am a conscientious objector. Everybody has to register. The process of declaring yourself to be a conscientious objector comes later, not at the beginning of it. So everyone, every male between the ages of 18 and 25 is supposed to be registered with the Selective Service System. It is a second degree felony not to register, and not registering makes men ineligible for some state and federal benefits. I have to say, on the other hand, there's no one who has been prosecuted for not registering since 1985. And there are some who would say that I cannot conscientiously register because they believe that then they're participating in an immoral system. I was taught, and I believe we continue to teach this, go ahead and register. That's what the law says. The provision to be a conscientious objector, that happens later, and there are provisions made for that in the law. That's the first thing, is registration. In a time of national emergency, and usually with a declaration of war, Congress would authorize the president to enact the draft. And then there would be a random drawing. I found it interesting that would be on live television, and they said it would also now be live streamed that you could watch. There would be a random drawing of birthdays of 20-year-olds and of a sequence of numbers. And the numbers would be assigned to birthdays of 20-year-olds. And so those 20-year-olds whose birthdays then got the number 1, they're the first ones that Selective Service System would send them a notice saying, report for duty. At that point, then, if you claimed exemption for whatever reason, but especially for our purposes, if you claimed exemption as a conscientious objector, at that point, if you received your notice and you said, I believe it is wrong and goes against the teaching of Christ to participate, then you would file for an exemption with your local draft board. And they would have to consider it. And if they gave you that exemption, then you would be assigned to alternative service, just the same as it was back in the Vietnam War, Korean, or World War II. That's still in place also, instead of military service. And if the 20-year-olds weren't enough, then they'd keep going with other ages and finish up with the 18-year-olds last. And if any of you want more information on that, I can provide you with some of that, either on registering or on the alternative service. I'd also recommend, just on the idea of non-resistance, go to BibleHelpsInc.org. You can read their booklets and articles there, or BRFWitness.org. There's good information there also. Now, what do we do with this practically, thinking about it? Well, first of all, some things for us as a church, just some reminders. Take all the teachings of the New Testament seriously. There are two things that I've heard, and I know these are slogans, but oftentimes slogans have truth that can help you to remember. What if Jesus really meant every word he said? So when he said these things about loving your enemies, what if he really meant every word he said there? Obviously he did. But if we really believe that he means every word that he says, how do we live that out? And you're right, it's a lot more than just not going to war, but it includes not going to war. So that would be one. And another phrase that I've heard often in connection with the brethren and the Mennonites of previous years is the attitude of just simply believe and simply obey. Jesus said these things. They're in the New Testament. They're really not hard to understand. And unless you go to it and you say, well, that doesn't make sense. Jesus couldn't have meant that we couldn't serve in the military, it's not hard to understand it. Believe it. Simply believe it, and then simply obey it. As a church, be faithful in our biblical duties toward the government authority over us. The fact that we withdraw from the military and don't participate in the military doesn't mean we don't have responsibilities toward the government. One is just to be a good person who obeys the laws as much as you can without violating God's laws. Live a good life. That's supporting the government. Pray for the government, the Bible says. And I have to confess, this is something that I don't know. It's just something I don't do as often, or like we talked about in our Sunday school lesson this morning. Maybe we do pray for our government, and later on in the day somebody comes in where we're at and complains about the price of gas or about all the ships that are anchored in the Los Angeles harbor, and we start complaining about those who are in authority over us. So in the morning we pray for them, and in the afternoon we complain about them and gripe about them. So probably that's not consistent. Something else that we have to be careful about, and I know that not everybody sees this the same way, but I read in multiple accounts of times that young men would be called before a draft board or called before authorities, and they'd be asked about their political participation and what they had done politically. And it's often been seen as inconsistent to, on the one hand, be politically active, especially if you're vocally politically active, and on the other hand, claim that you're not a citizen of the kingdom of this world. So that's something to think about, of how that might run into problems. Also, as a church, the idea of alternative service. I was talking with the brother this morning about this. When those of you who were considered for the Korean War or for the Vietnam War wanted to be or wanted to claim conscientious objector status, you had alternative service you could go to. I don't think there's as much of that set up now. Surprisingly, there is actually something run by the selective service system called the Alternative Service Employers Network. They are really trying to get a network of employers who could do alternative service for the nation in those categories that were mentioned and have them registered so that if the draft ever would be reenacted, there would be places for people to work in the national interest. But they can't find people who will apply to be in that. Local and state governments, there would be some options there. And there are other things at the federal government level. But there would even be private employers or private schools or other things that do work that's in the public interest who could apply to be part of the Alternative Service Employers Network. And maybe that's something that each of us should consider. Is there something that we're involved with, or do we know an organization that could become part of that network? To parents, what can we do? First is teach our children the principles of non-resistance. And as I reflect on this, I don't think I did a very good job at this. I don't think I talked enough with my children about the principles of this. I don't think that I always exemplified the principles of non-resistance. You know, you kind of let your guard down sometimes, and your children see sides of you that maybe you wouldn't show to others. In words and action, and even in your prayers and family devotions, pray for those who are in authority over you. Pray for your enemies. If there are people who are opposing you and your children know it, pray for those people in front of your children. Things like that. As parents, we can help our sons when they turn 18 to know what to do and talk it through with them. And especially to you youth, well, it's not there right now, but it could be. The potential is there. Now is the time, though, for you to decide, where do you stand on this? Think seriously about the New Testament. Think seriously about your commitment to Christ, about the sacrifices of those in the past and what they did, how firmly they believed in this, and don't believe it just because they believed in it a lot, but let that be a sign to you of something that, you know, this is really important and I need to think carefully about it. Settle it in your mind now before it becomes a question that you have to face. When it is time, follow the law, register, it's legally required. And I actually have from someone in the selective service system, if you knowingly refuse to register, that almost automatically keeps you from being classified as a conscientious objector. They say you've already committed a felony, and so they would not look favorably on that if you applied for that status. This is something I heard a lot when I was growing up. Live consistently with the testimony that you might have to give before a draft board. Now, when I was young, we were told things like, don't get in trouble at school because the draft board will look at that, which they might have. But it goes further than that now. Now they look at things like your social media platforms and presence there too. What are you sharing on social media? What are you saying? What memes are you reposting? Are they things that go along with the idea of not retaliating and of being non-resistant and of loving your enemies? Or would they be things that support those? A record with law enforcement? The things that you say? Whether it would be talking about standing up for yourself, defending yourself, all of those. Even things about the government could be considered. Now, something else, I know Brother Tom used to do this with the youth. One thing you could do is make yourself a conscientious objector file. Start with that. Write out a statement of your beliefs, and it doesn't have to be anything fancy. You can just say, I believe that it is wrong for me as a believer to participate in the military, and then give some of your reasons and sign and date it and keep that.
put a copy of your baptismal certificate in with that to show that, yes, you are a member of a church that does not believe in this. And when one thing that's been suggested, and I did this when I registered, it was a paper form at my time. Now you can do it online. I would recommend that you actually use the paper form still, fill it out, write across it, I am a conscientious objector. Make a copy, keep the copy for yourself, and mail the form. You have registered, but you've already established where you stand on the issue. It is something, the idea of non-resistance, it's hard to live out. I've wondered what I would have done if I were ever called before a draft board, but I know that there were times that I failed personally in being non-resistant in personal relationships. But just thinking about how important it has been to some in the past, like I mentioned in the Civil War, and the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia was really hit hard. First, the Confederates took over, then the Union Army came through, then the Confederates went through again, and then the Union Army back and forth and back and forth. And anybody who was there who looked like they were healthy and could serve in the military was subject to that. And there were a lot of Brethren and Mennonites living in the Shenandoah Valley. And sometimes they were swept up in this. And how important is it? One Mennonite woman, Barbara Herr, her three sons became soldiers, and she grieved so much that she wished her sons had died in their youth. That's what it meant to her. Even though they had been conscripted against their will, they went to the bishop before they left, and they said that they didn't have anything else they could do, and they pledged their commitment to him, saying that they wouldn't shoot. At the end of one battle, one Mennonite boy who had been taken in with no choice, his captain asked him if he had fired his weapon, and he said no. And the captain said, well, why not? Don't you see all these Yankees over there? And he said, no, they're people. And he said, we don't shoot people. And of course, as brethren, we have the testimony of John Klein, the elder who lived in Virginia, and continually went back and forth crossing enemy lines with permission during the Civil War, trying to encourage the brethren on both sides not to participate in the military, to talk to the governors of Virginia, and I believe Maryland and other places to try to get exemptions. Eventually, John Klein was on his way home from annual meeting in 1864 when he was shot and killed because of this. It's something that has meant a lot to people in the past. And again, we don't do it just because of their example, but that shows how much it meant to them. Jesus said it, the New Testament teaches it, and there have been people all through the Christian ages that have been ready to sacrifice their property, their liberty, or even their lives for it. So if these things are so important, then for us, it merits our serious consideration also.
I remember as a young man going through a class about this, and I remember the apprehensiveness that I had thinking about this. It's a little bit different, but tonight I want us to think about the one call that God has given each one of us. Each one of us that accepted the call of salvation, accepted God's call in our lives, and have trying to live a godly life. It's a call of devotion to God already in each one of our lives. That it's no different than the draft. God is calling each one of us to be faithful. He will give us the power and the strength in the time that we are needed. So practice in our daily lives as we come face to face with each other to show God's mercy, to show what he means to us. And there's one phrase that Brother Paul mentioned this morning that just made you think of, is what makes a strong church? It's not necessarily the leaders. It's how serious each one of us as members take our Christianity. And I challenge that with each one of us this evening. Let's stand for a word of prayer.